This is episode number 781 with Sol Rashidi, author of Your AI Survival Guide. Today's episode is brought to you by AWS Cloud Computing Services.
Welcome to the Super Data Science Podcast, the most listened to podcast in the data science industry. Each week, we bring you inspiring people and ideas to help you build a successful career in data science. I'm your host, John Crone. Thanks for joining me today. And now, let's make the complex simple.
Welcome back to the Super Data Science Podcast. Today, you're in for a treat yet again with the unbelievably intelligent and well-spoken Sol Rashidi. Sol has been a serial C-suite leader at Fortune 100 companies, with roles like Chief Analytics Officer, Chief Data Officer, and Chief AI Officer at Estee Lauder, Merck Pharmaceuticals, Sony Music, and Royal Caribbean Cruise Lines. She also led the Digital and Innovation Practice at Ernst & Young and was the partner leading the Watson go-to-market at IBM. In all, Sol's been involved in over 36 large-scale data and AI implementations and been recognized with a string of international awards for her leadership, 8 patents granted, and many more patents pending. Her first book, Your AI Survival Guide, Scraped Knees, Bruised Elbows, and Lessons Learned from Real-World AI Deployments, was published by Wiley just a few days ago. If you'd like a copy of Sol's excellent AI Survival Guide book, let me know. I will personally ship 10 physical copies of Your AI Survival Guide to people who comment or reshare the LinkedIn post that I publish about Sol's episode from my personal LinkedIn account today. Simply mention in your comment or reshare that you'd like the book. I'll hold a draw to select the 10 book winners next week, so you have until Sunday, May 12th to get involved with this book contest. Today's episode will be invaluable to anyone who'd like to succeed at deploying AI models commercially. In this episode, Sol details her straightforward system for selecting the enterprise AI projects that will be successfully deployed, what kinds of AI projects should always be avoided, why larger enterprises drag their feet on impactful AI projects and how to overcome such corporate logjams, when you should patent an innovation, and why chief data officers and related C-suite roles have such high turnover. All right, you ready for this jaw-droppingly awesome episode? Let's go. Sol, yes, welcome to the Super Data Science Podcast. It's awesome to have you here. Where in the world are you calling in from today?
I am really fortunate. I'm actually calling from Miami, which is my home base, but I feel like I've been a ping pong. The past month has been like nuts. It's been Saudi Arabia, Indonesia, Geneva, Paris. I just got back from Big Sky, Montana, which I would have never have gone if it wasn't for this one particular event. And I don't know if anyone's ever been to Montana. It is breathtaking. And then Chicago and San Fran. So it's just been all over the place, but I'm so happy that for the first time in like 4 weeks, I'm finally home. And fantastic. You guys get to open up my day and I get to open up my day with you. So super excited to be here.
Yeah, we're delighted to have you on the show. You and I met a few weeks ago at the time of recording near Miami. I guess the first time we met was on a cruise ship that was docked in Miami. And then, so this was sort of something called Summit at Sea, which was wild. I've never experienced anything like it. I had heard about it for years and was not disappointed. Indeed, my high expectations were exceeded. I think the best way that it was described to me, to sum it up in one phrase, is it was like TED Talks meets Burning Man.
Yeah. And I would even add like wellness programs in there. Right. And like, thank goodness for our buddy Jepson. He'd invited you and I had a dear friend of mine invite me. And so it was amazing because like when we met, we're sort of in the same crew and we had like 500 plus people in common on LinkedIn. And we're like, wait, but you know Joe Reese, you know Jepson, you know so-and-so, you know so-and-so. And I'm like, how is it that we have not met until that random happenstance Summit at Seas, which was, I agree with you, absolutely phenomenal. So I'm glad I got the pleasure.
Yeah. And I'd been recently stalking you online because I saw that you had this new book coming out and I was really fascinated by it. And I was like, wow, it'd be great to have Sol on the show someday. And bam, now here you are. Oh, we made it happen. Thank you, Jepson.
You manifested that. But Jepson's also a great connector. So
I think he's manifesting everything, and we're just puppets in that scheme.
Knowing Jepsen, yes, I would agree.
You have been in the C-suite at a bunch of Fortune 100 companies, very well-known brands. So Estee Lauder, Merck, Sony Music, Royal Caribbean, speaking of cruise lines, and Ernst & Young. In those roles, you've implemented a lot of transformation with AI and data, but I understand that you've also maybe made a professional transformation yourself as well.
I have. You know, it's amazing how some of the people that I meet, they're serial entrepreneurs and they've always had that like fire in them. In my case, I've always been in corporate America. I've always been in enterprise. I was a CAO, CDO, CAIO, CDAO, whatever CXO it is. And so they, you know, when companies decide that we want to do a data transformation or we want to do an AI transformation or we want to do X transformation, if there's a dependency on AI applications or data, usually they bring me in. I've loved the journey, but you're right. As of 7-8 months ago, I am what I call a retired and recovering C-suite executive. Okay. I said, no mas. And it's really scary because like entrepreneurs naturally can't imagine working for anyone else. All I've done is work for someone else. I'm a child of immigrant parents and they came here after the revolution. It was all about having a steady income and working for a good company. And that was just my path. But 7-8 months ago, you know, I just hit a wall and I was like, you know, by the time I get these companies up to date, I'm going to be out of date with the way the market is going and the pace of change. And it was mostly alignment discussions, virtually actually building. And I'm very much a builder. I'm very much a creator. I love getting my hands in the weeds. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to give up the logo. I'm going to give up the paycheck. I'm going to go out on my own without much of a plan and just see what happens. It's been an amazing ride and like hats off to every entrepreneur because in this journey now, I found I really love working with startups and scale-ups. Phenomenal founders, phenomenal developers, phenomenal engineers. Most of them don't have a commercial backbone. Most of them can't take the concept and understand around processes and operations and go to market and building that playbook that allows them to translate the problems they're solving with what's applicable in the marketplace. And I found my little niche of being an advisor to startups and entrepreneurs and helping them bridge that gap between the two, of them building really cool stuff and then knowing what to do with it. So it's been fun. It's been fun.
So yeah, that's fantastic. So yeah, after all those years of the stability at these big brands, you're now working, I guess, fractionally with startup founders to bring your commercial know-how to the great technical ideas that they have around AI.
Yeah, I swore I would never be a full-time CDO again or a full-time CAIO again. It's too messy right now. And I've been in the thick of it, right? If you ask any CDO, I've held the position 4 times over. I was one of the first ones appointed, if not the first one, back in 2016 as the Chief Data and AI Officer for Royal Caribbean. And it was still new. People didn't understand what the role was. But right now, I swore I'd never go and do a full-time job. So I am playing the fractional role for enterprises, but I'm playing an advisory role for a lot of startups. It doesn't pay the bills, but it's what fulfills me the most. So I have to balance the two.
Okay. Yeah, but in totality, all these pursuits together have ended up paying the bills, I guess, in that time, which is great.
Yeah. I mean, you don't make money, obviously, by writing a book. Everyone knows that, at least not yet, unless you're a guy. Speaking, that's been interesting. People actually want to hear what I have to say. And oddly enough, the book's title is Scrape Your AI Survival Guide, but it's about the scraped knees and the bruised elbows. I'm very good at talking about all the mistakes I made. I have no issues talking about how many times I made mistakes with people, with projects, with cultures. But every time I made a mistake, I learned and I just got better and better at it.
Yeah, before we dig into the book, which I do want to dig into, my understanding from the data, from seeing studies, is that CDOs, chief data officers, and I'm sure it's the same for all those kinds of related titles that you've had, like chief analytics officer and chief AI officer, the turnover in those roles is super fast. And
insane.
Could you speak to why that happens?
Yeah. I legitimately thought I was 100% flawed. because I had had the position at Royal Caribbean. And even though things went into hypercare by the time I was done, there was still more work to do. And then the turnover. Then I went to Sony Music, COVID hit, turnover. And then luckily, Gartner had finally published something on the average tenureship of a CDO, and it was 18 months. And I'm like, well, amazing. I'm beating the average at least. Like, woohoo. But like, my goal in life is never to beat the average. Yeah. My goal is to crush the average and like set the new benchmark. But I was like, okay, at least this turnover, now that more people are getting the CDO position, and I'm not like the only one on an island, the turnover is really fast. And there's sort of a few legs in that stool. The division of labor is never clearly articulated when you come in. You have a CIO, CTO, CAO, CDO, the other CDO, the chief digital officer. Like, it's whether your company has one or two or a mix. There is very little effort in putting and outlining the division of labor. Where does one role start and end, and where does the other one start and end? So if I come on board as a chief data officer, and my job is to establish a data strategy to understand where we're weak, where we're inefficient, what desires are needed, what capabilities we need to build. Part of that, I call this the offensive and defensive playbook. The defensive playbook is, what's our data ecosystem? Do we even have an architecture that supports the business capabilities? Do we have enough engineers? Do we have enough analysts? Do we have enough scientists? Do we have a semantic layer that enables self-service analytics? What's our orchestration observability? Do we even have a catalog? So even if we put all this effort, people know where to go to with the data. But then a lot of it is around performance and making information available. Okay, well, how do I make it available? Well, this data is in this application. This data is in that application. If I don't own the systems, the applications, the platforms, the warehouses, the lake environments, I cannot guarantee the orchestration, the observability, the cataloging, the quality, and the way in which data is accessible. Everything I need as a foundation completely crumbles if I don't have ownership. But classically, who has ownership of that ecosystem? The CIO. And the CIO has nothing to do with me, but they're pissed my role even exists, because more than likely, the business has decided to take resources away, to take responsibility away. And it's a very, in my opinion, if I was a CIO, I would take it this way. Like, I'm not doing a good enough job around data and analytics. And that's why we had to bring in another C-suite who's just going to be maniacally focused on this. So there's a little bit of a subtle backhanded, like, we're not doing enough, so we're going to bring someone else in. So that division of labor between the CIO and CDO becomes really, really murky. And I've had really healthy relationships where the CIO has prioritized the things that I needed to do because we both look good. And I've had really unhealthy relationships where the CIO wants to be the hero and the only hero, and the business is already screaming at 100 things that they don't have. I'm like the last on the totem pole, right? So how am I going to get my job if I have a dependency on that team and that team has completely deprioritized my work? So it gets really frustrating. I think the second aspect, so that's division of labor. A lot of CDOs are brought on board to fix governance and quality. With all due respect, you can be in that position for 100 years. You'll never fix governance and quality. And so they don't see the value. And oftentimes when I go in a position, I'm like, okay, we have two choices. I know where the issues are around governance. Either you can give me the funding and the focus to go and fix the root cause, which is a business process in system A and a business process in system B, but I need ownership and authority in fixing the business processes that are actually generating the issues. And I need priority in prioritizing the format and configuration within our SAP system, within our CDP system, because we're allowing for free form and it shouldn't be free form. It should follow this standardized format so that once we get the structured database or once we get the structured data, it has hygiene. Or the other option is you're just going to have to perpetually fund me with a bunch of pails to catch that leaky faucet of quality data, and I'm going to have to fix it reactively. So give me the focus and funding to go fix it proactively, or you're going to have to give me enough budget to continually react to it, but we'll never catch up. So like that's the second, is if I don't have ownership rights or I can't influence how business processes need to alter and change, that also goes by the wayside and the business don't see things like governance and quality. And then I think the third is most CDO, I shouldn't say most. I have some of my peers who are really great at this and some of mine who are still learning because it's their first job in. You have to be front and center with the business. You have to be attached at the hip. You have to be there with all their digital marketing campaigns, MarTech tools. It has to matter to them for you to matter to the organization, because it's not about what you're actually doing. It's about the perceived value you're bringing. And they only can do that if they see you front and center and trying to help them. So that's the reason why. And there's a lot of other cultural components that kick in as well, some nuances, but I would say those are the three primary legs in the stool of why the average tendership is 18 months. Perceived value, ownership and rights, and then the division of labor is unclear.
Are you stuck between optimizing latency and lowering your inference costs as you build your generative AI applications? Find out why more ML developers are moving toward AWS Trainium and Inferentia to build and serve their large language models. You can save up to 50% on training costs with AWS Trainium chips and up to 40% on inference costs with AWS Inferentia chips. Trainium and Inferentia will help you achieve higher performance, lower costs, and be more sustainable. Check out the links in the show notes to learn more. All right, now back to our show. You're doing my job for me here, Sol. I'm taking notes here to be able to recap your main points back to you, and you just did it. I'll just give you the questions, and you can. No, it's perfect. You're an amazing podcast guest because you make it so easy. You're articulate about everything. You put everything into enumerated points as opposed to just kind of continuing on and on and on. And you keep those points clearly in your head and then enumerate them back to the audience. It's perfect. Yeah. So, I mean,
thank you.
You just said it, but yeah, it sounds like there's high CDO turnover because there's no clear division of labor. You're brought in to fix data governance and quality, but you don't have the remit to actually fix that. And you need to have a high perceived value. But that was actually on that last point there on the high perceived value. Why is it that that's difficult to achieve?
I think if you take a look at most of us and how we grew up, you know, to be an effective CDO, you need to know data. And to know data, you didn't grow up in the business. You either were a data architect, you were a data engineer, you were a data scientist, or at a minimum, you were a manager managing the individual contributors, or you were an MDM lead, or you were a data steward. Whatever role you held, you kind of clawed your way up, because it's not like this is a natural and easy trajectory to achieve. It just isn't. In any number of those positions, you're part of that defensive playbook, not the offensive playbook. You're very much a back office contributor. And so you're not front and center. And when you're not front and center, you don't develop the muscles of communication. You don't develop the muscles of EQ. And this was the first lesson I learned, like legitimately. And I think there's a part in the book, but also something that I talk about. And Joe Reese and I actually are teaching a course on this on Maven. The higher up you go, the less it's actually about your IQ, and the more it's about your BQ, SQ, and EQ, your business quotient, your social quotient, and your emotional quotient. I had no clue. And I would say that I built a lot of cool stuff in my first C-suite position. I fell on my face, not knowing that the first three were the most critical components of being a successful executive. So while everyone couldn't debate that, yeah, she's smart, she knows her stuff, I did not understand the complexities of what it takes to build a relationship in order to scale everything I was building, because a lot of it is a leap of faith and a lot of it is still human to human interaction. And so that was a hard lesson that I learned. And so I've always placed relationships first now, at least with business leaders. And that doesn't come natural to us when we've played in back office role for a really long time.
Well said. Wow. I'm sure that resonates with a lot of listeners out there. That kind of experience as people have grown up, you know, with these incredible technical skills in data science and machine learning and engineering. And then as they've made their way up an organization, they get outflanked by people who are great at kind of manipulating the social system at the top of the hierarchy.
And it's so frustrating. Like, have you ever had a manager and you're like, how did this ding dong get this role? Like, this person's legitimately doesn't know the space. I don't understand. Or I've had peers where I'm like, why are you in this role? You clearly just said something that is so not true, but because no one else in the room understands our space, they can't tell the difference between fact and fiction. And then you realize that they moved up, not because they were the smartest or the most competent. It was because they leaned on all the other things and they just kind of, I hate to use the word weasel, but like, I will, because I don't have respect for people who don't know their space. That's just what they did. And so if you ever wonder, how did this person become a manager? How did this person become the boss? Like, they don't know the space. it's because they understood the EQ, BQ, and SQ, and they aligned with the right individuals.
Nicely said. Lots of lessons there. All right. I promised we'd get into the book, so let's get into it. AI Survival Guide. That's a humorous title. You don't see enough funny titles in technical books. But yeah, AI Survival Guide, we're obviously going to have a link to that in the show notes and a giveaway as well. So we'll be giving away the book to people who would like it. I would have announced that in the episode introduction. And so, yeah, really exciting. Tell us about why you decided that the world needs this book. And yeah, kind of give us an overall overview of the book, for example, perhaps by letting us know what some common concerns are about AI and mm-hmm. how your book addresses them.
So when I resigned, I noticed that like this space, I've been doing it since 2011. I helped IBM launch Watson, and I've been doing concepts, use case selections, design, development, and deployment for 13 years. And like the world just woke up to it, which I'm grateful for, because I think the difference between Watson and ChatGPT is one was very B2B centric. Only enterprises could leverage AI, but now it's democratized to the masses. So it's just created a bit of a rude awakening. So the good news is everyone's talking about it. It's not just some innovation lab that I'm running behind the scenes that's really cool. And then like, hey, there's value in here. Let's push it to production. The heartburn that I fundamentally have is I struggle with theorists. I struggle with those that read and regurgitate. I struggle with those that call themselves an expert or are an advisor, and they've never done the work. I just struggle. I'm like, you've got to be in the weeds to understand that in this situation, this doesn't work. But in that situation, it could work if you. And so having gone through all the deployments, having gone through the development trenches, the cultural trenches, the transformation trenches, the building of the trenches, like the teams that I inherit that I have to change or the teams that I have to build. I was just reading all the stuff and people were calling themselves experts and advisors. I'm like, how? Like if you look at their CV, a year and a half ago on LinkedIn, their title was like senior manager of cyber, and now they're an AI expert, or senior manager of, I don't know, business process optimization, and now they're an AI. I'm like, WTF, it just doesn't make any sense. And so when I was on the speaking circuit, a few people had mentioned like, you know a lot, but you're not talking about it. Why don't you write a book? Why don't you become more active on social media? I was like, it's not me. I'm not the hard salesperson. I sell by doing, not by speaking. And they're like, you need to get out there. And a dear friend of mine, his name is Steve Newry. I think you guys know him on LinkedIn. Major following.
Oh, yeah. You know, I've never met him, but I think I am going to be meeting him very soon. I think I'm going to be meeting him in May, finally. He was a guest on the show, Steve Newry. Yeah, he was in episode number 409, but that was a few weeks before I took over as host of this podcast. Yeah, really eager to meet him. He has an unbelievable following online in the AI space.
Yeah.
I should also note, this is now that we're just talking about dates and I'm interrupting you, you should note that your book has just come out at the time of this being. So it's last week that your book came out, so people can be going out and buying it. Anyway, sorry, I've completely interrupted you, derailed the conversation. Steve Newry, you were talking about Steve Newry.
Yeah. Well, we were in Dubai and we were just chatting. And then 2 months later, he'd introduced me to Wiley Publishing. And they wanted to do more work on leadership and AI and the crossover, and things just gelled. And legitimately, I think we signed the contract in 2 weeks and I wrote the book in 3-4 months because I wasn't thinking. I had already done everything. And I had to go back through every file folder from every employer, and what I've deployed, what I discovered, and all my notes. And so it was, the difficult task was not coming up with the topics. It was aggregating it in a cohesive way so that non-technologists could understand the coursework and technologists could understand some of the things that they're potentially missing in the conversations.
And you've done over, if I remember correctly, you've done over 30 production deployments, like serious kind of global AI production or data. Yeah.
I have just under 40 enterprise grade AI applications in production. And they're still alive and well. I think 3 have been decommissioned. There just wasn't enough talent or they couldn't carry it over into the new AI stack. So I think 3 have been decommissioned based on some folks that still work at the companies. But yeah, so I decided, okay, I'm going to get rid of the hype and all of the that's on LinkedIn and some of the theoretical sources and like, just buckle down. Like, here's my favorite. And I've gone into clients right now. They're like, here are the use cases that we established with these management consulting firms. I'm like, that's great. But 3/4 of those aren't going to work. And they're like, well, why not? And I'm like, you can do POCs. You'll be very successful in the POC, but 7 of those 11, you can't push to production. And the question is, why not? I'm like, well, because of X, Y, and Z. Oh. So like, for example, one of the chapters is really around, how do you even, what the heck goes into an AI strategy? We talk about it, just like a data strategy. Have you ever built one and communicated it to the board and fully flushed out what a strategy looks like? Of how are we going to enable you with data? Or how are we going to enable you with AI in a way that's comprehensible, understandable, touches on all the points that everyone can understand, whether you're technical or not? Most people don't have that experience. And then most people pick an AI strategy because they're like, oh, we want to focus on productivity or we want to focus on efficiency. Okay. But based on your existing maturity across infrastructure, data, and talent, and there's 5 strategies, for example, growth-based, knowledge-based, productivity-based, efficacy-based, and efficiency-based. Each one has a different set of requirements that you need to have on infrastructure, data, and talent. You can't leverage AI and be a growth-based strategy if fundamentally you have a conservative culture, you're in a highly regulated industry, and your enterprise data can't be ingested into LLMs without extreme heightened data privacy and data leakage protocols. It's just not possible. So love the fact that you want to be a growth-based AI strategy, or you want to deploy a growth-based AI strategy around raising NPS scores or consumer experiences and personalization. You culturally actually can't do it. And from a maturity perspective, you can't do it. And here are the reasons why. People don't know that unless they've actually gone through the deployment. The other aspect of it is like the use cases. Don't pick a use case based on business value. That's a big no-no. Because what's business value to manufacturing versus business value to supply chain versus business value to your financial advisors versus business value to procurement? There is inherent business value in every use case. And if you ever find yourself in the position to be the tiebreaker or decide what you're going to take on, you have naturally picked sides. Because you can find business value in everything. There's just so much improvements that can benefit from the applications of artificial intelligence. So I invented this framework back when I was in IBM called the criticality and complexity matrix. The criticality of it is you go through a series of questions. Is there imminent threat by a competitor? Are there regulations and fines that are coming down the line? Are you losing market share? Right now it's single digits, but forecasting shows it could be double digits. Like, you go through the list and the questions are there, and then you rate them. And it gives you a weight. And then you go through complexity. And within complexity, you measure, okay, do you have the basics of infrastructure? And here's what you need. Do you have the basics of data? And here's what you need. Do you have the basics of operational agility? Because you're going to have to redesign the operational model. Here's XYZ and the talent XYZ. And then you give each a weight. And then depending on where things plot, if it's highly complex and low criticality, it's a no-brainer. You don't do it. If it's highly critical and low complexity to deploy, those are your use cases. There's a lot that's going to fall into highly critical, somewhat complex to deploy. Those are the ones that require negotiation, but don't start with that first because you haven't developed the muscles internally yet. Like, so there's a method to the madness. And all of this is to avoid getting into what I call perpetual POC purgatory, which is where most folks are right now. So there's like real tangible stuff. So it teaches hardcore technologists like how to think like business executives and how to communicate. But then for non-technologists, how do you even start? And there's like an example of a woman who has a business who's faced with a conundrum and she wants to use AI, but she doesn't know if it's appropriate. And like the entire walkthrough and exercise, like hosting workshops, developing a strategy, explaining the why, how to select the use case, how to measure productivity. So just real, real stuff. And so that's why I call it your survival guide, because it's like, it's not a playbook. It's not a strategy. It's not high in the sky, like management consulting stuff. It's, if you're going to do it, let me explain to you all the mistakes I made and learn from those mistakes so you don't have to go through them yourself.
Since the start of April, I've been offering my Machine Learning Foundations curriculum live online via a series of 14 training sessions within the O'Reilly platform. My curriculum provides all the foundational mathematical knowledge you need to understand contemporary machine learning applications, including deep learning, LLMs, and AI in general. The linear algebra classes are wrapping up soon, but my calculus, probability, statistics, and computer science classes are still to come. The first two calculus sessions are available for registration now. We've got the links for you in the show notes, and those will cover all the essential calculus you need for machine learning. Calculus level 1 will be on May 22nd, calculus level 2 will be on June 5th, and registration will open soon for calculus levels 3 and 4, which will be on June 26th and July 10th. If you don't already have access to O'Reilly, you can get a free 30-day trial via our special code, which is also in the show notes. It would be so easy for me at this point to say something that sounds like absolute bluster, but hopefully I've had, for people that have been listening to the show long enough, know that what I'm about to say is not hyperbolic and is not something that I would usually say all the time. What you just described, the kind of expertise that you just demonstrated and the way that you articulated, I feel like I have to read your book. And I have, I have 15 years of commercial machine learning experience. And I have already learned so much in the last few minutes that I feel like I've got to get it right now, because who knows what terrible trap I'm walking into in my very next step and my next idea about an AI deployment. Yeah, this sounds valuable.
You're very
something, something that I did pick up about your approach. So I already liked how you talked about a focus on high criticality, low complexity projects to maximize the odds of success on an AI deployment. Another thing that's really interesting to me is that, from my understanding, you don't think that business value is the key marker to look on, to look at when choosing an AI project, which is counterintuitive. And we have had several episodes on this show with guests who specialize in helping you get business value out of AI projects. And that's kind of the main point, is the main point that they make is if you want to have success in an AI project, it's got to deliver business value. And that's basically it. That's the fundamental bottom line that's been said on the show many times. And it sounds like you have a contrarian point of view.
I do, because unless you've done it, you realize how you could trip. And here's my point. Like, I always say this. I'm like, strategy without proper execution is basic hallucination. I could dream, I can envision, I can articulate all the business value I want on a deck, and I do a damn good job of it. But unless I can follow through and execute on it, it means nothing. And my word means everything. So if I'm going to say I'm going to do something, I'm going to do something, which is why I've been given all these opportunities. I am a woman of my word. So yeah, I can tell you that by deploying this, we're going to be able to reduce headcount. And I hate, by the way, there's a section on that one. I will get into that in a second. But we can improve operational efficiency by 22%. We can increase productivity by 31%. We could expedite time to market by 11%. If I'm the CEO of a company, and we have a strategic initiative to be more EBITDA healthy, and I need to raise my EBITDA by 6 points, all of those things matter. Which one do I choose first? Because I need to improve productivity. I need to be more efficient. I need to be more effective, because the halo effect of those aggregated will create my 6 point differential that I need to hit my EBITDA markets, my EBITDA targets. Where do you start? How do you know which one you're going to execute the best on? You don't. Because if it was purely based off of business value as the hook, all three are really important. So that's why I'm saying is there's the execution side that most theorists, most researchers, most folks that haven't had the responsibility or the accountability of pushing something into production so that they could say that they did what they promised they would, don't realize that the complexity to deploy needs to be a factor into the decision making. So business value is important, but it's one of the 12 questions I ask before I determine how we're going to prioritize use case deployment, because I'm going to choose the one that has the highest chance of probability of pushing into production. Otherwise, what good is a POC?
Nice. Yeah. So that really is building upon the point that you made earlier about focusing on high criticality, low complexity projects. So that lower complexity is key to this project ultimately being a success, especially with a certain amount of, with a finite amount of resources. A really quick terminology, so term for people, our business listeners will know this one for sure. Our data science listeners may not, which is EBITDA. So earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. It's basically, we're just saying net income. So, you know, a project being profitable, basically earning more money than it costs to run.
Yeah. It's like the organizational marker of being able to do more with less. That's what EBITDA is. And so for anyone who's going to get, if you, and you know what, entrepreneurs and data scientists, if you start your own company, I know that when VCs are looking at you, they're going to look at logos, they're going to look at ARR, they're going to look at NRR, but when you're officially in a scale up and you're going to get into the private equity world, they're going to start talking EBITDA language. So.
Yep. I've experienced that in the startup world for sure.
You have, and a successful one too.
A framework that comes to mind for me is the RICE model, which we see in product prioritization. So where you have four attributes that you evaluate any potential project that you could take on. So the reach, the impact, the confidence, and the effort, where the broader the reach of this, say, AI project that you're thinking of getting together, you know, that should be prioritizing the project more, the impact that that will have on those people that you're going to reach with this AI improvement, the bigger the impact, the higher the RICE score, your confidence in the project, C. So this allows you to have some, you know, projects that are going to have more R&D, that have maybe more complexity, more unknowns, they should be lower confidence, and then that drags down your RICE score. And then finally, most important related to this complexity is the effort score, the E in RICE. And the larger, the more effort that a project takes, it dramatically lowers the overall RICE score for a given project. So I don't know if that's...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Very, very similar. And it's because of the RICE framework that I stopped doing self-service analytics as a capability. I've learned the hard way. The reach is not there. The impact is high for the small reach, but the reach has never been to the degree that we had hoped. And you put in all this effort developing a data architecture and semantic layers and self-service capabilities and automating authorization, authentication, and like the juice versus the squeeze just isn't worth it, oddly enough. Here's another one of my favorites as well. You know, as AI, 2023, everyone was starting. 2024, everyone's really focused on scaling. And then there's this consistent theme around responsible AI, ethical AI, data privacy, data leakage. I don't think any of those things should be an inhibitor or a showstopper, because I'm a big believer that if there's a will, there's a way. And there's an element in the book where we talk about what the heck those things mean. But I think that there's two things that also stand out. If you're a practitioner and this is a roadblock for you, or if you're a leader and you want to understand how to overcome this roadblock, or if you're an entrepreneur and you're developing solutions, I think this is going to be important for you. There's this natural apprehension with an enterprise, or just... I would say any company that makes over 150 million, 200 million, doesn't have to be enterprise, but mostly an enterprise, about the what if scenarios. And what if our data leaks? What if our confidential data gets out there? What if we have proprietary data and it's not protected properly? And I'm like, well, what if I cross the street and get hit by a car? What if I take a flight in any one of my travels and the plane doesn't get to the destination? There is always a chance. But it doesn't mean that I'm never going to get out of my car, or get out of my home and not walk across the street, or never hop on another plane again, because the odd and probability is low. But even so, there are so many, there's just so many mitigation components that are out there. And there's some brilliant entrepreneurs that are working on solutions that I don't think data leakage or AI data privacy should ever stop anyone. And here's an example. I know the topic of data privacy is like womp, 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 like eyes roll back, like, oh, I don't want to talk about it. And I'm like, okay, well, let's just give me a second. right? You have bidirectional encryption. Encryption, unfortunately, is still a risk component when you're training LLM models with enterprise data, because you can encrypt it on the way to the model, but you have to de-encrypt it in order for the LLM to be able to read the text, and understand what you're fine-tuning on, what you're doing inference on, et cetera. So you can't use standard data privacy and data security practices with AI applications. And I think this is the first mistake most people make. You have to dig and you have to research AI-centric solutions that are out there that have existed out there, but haven't necessarily been commercialized yet because we're 2-3 years into this mass journey of ours. But like one of the solutions, one of the technologies, one of the companies that I've discovered that I've worked with is Protopia.ai. And it's a brilliant way of, instead of, and anytime like the CIO comes to me, the CISO comes to me, or an enterprise, well, what about data leakage? I'm like, well, no, we have a solution for that. It's not a problem. They're like, well, how is it? I'm like, well, it's not our normal standard data security, data privacy. The field of AI is very different. So in this particular case, we use stochastic mechanisms, which means, and it's in a weird way, call it like a stained glass transformation. I'm going to use encryption language because that's what most people know. What you encrypt data, so you secure it, but then you have to de-encrypt it so you can analyze it. But with the stochastic modeling, what Protopia has been able to do for enterprises is you mask it, which is not the same as encryption, but you mask it. So So John Doe with their birthday, with their annual income, looks like ABC underscore asterisk 123. But the LLM can read the masked version of the text. So you don't have to de-encrypt it, which is what you do with data privacy and security. The LLM model itself can actually read the masked version. So it's essentially masked or encrypted on the way in, but you don't have to de-encrypt it if I were to use data privacy languages. But in AI languages, you mask it and cover it. So if there were data leakages, if there were privacy concerns, you can't see it on the way in. But the best part is the LLM model itself can actually read the masked information, and you can do all the training and tuning and inference modeling you want. I say that because oftentimes when we're having those discussions of pushing things into production, inevitably months and months of conversation will go by with steering committees, with compliance, with risk, with the CISO, with the CIO. And there are so many solutions out there. Don't let the organization use that as a clutch or as a hook to not push something into production, because there are solutions that solve for that very problem right now. And so that's, to me, that's huge, because that inevitably has always been the showstopper historically, but we have a lot of advantages that there are solutions. If there's a will, there's a way. And if you just do some research and forensics, stuff like stained glass transformations, masking data, Protopia and many other companies have solved those problems. So there isn't an excuse anymore. And I just want to make sure that people understand and know that things can happen at an enterprise grade.
I totally buy it. We actually had a guest in episode number 701, Raluca Adapopa. She's a professor who specializes in these kinds of encryption, decryption, masking, exactly the kind of stuff you were describing for LLMs. And so I've, since last summer with that episode, I'm like, wow, yeah, there is no reason why enterprise can't be adopting large language models and AI.
And if they're pushing back, it's because they don't know, John. That's the thing. Like, it's so important. Like, it's not that you have to be in the know, because I can barely keep up with the pace of change. But when you're in the know or you've done it, you know solutions exist. So there's no reason.
Great points. A point that you made a little while ago that you wanted to get back to, but we had to put a pin in, was you were going to say something about reducing headcount.
So right now I'm seeing a lot of decks of companies that I'm helping. And one of the promises to CEOs and a way to sell AI at scale is it will reduce your workforce by 28%, 35%. 16%. I call BS on that for a few reasons. I know it's a good selling point, and I think with right now the way the economy is going, every CEO is looking at their budgets, and things are tight, right? There've been massive rifts, massive layoffs. I totally get it. I actually left my former employer when CapEx was cut by nearly 50%. It was insane. But I have never in my entire career, and I've never known a peer of mine in their entire career. I've never known anyone that has deployed AI into production where there has been layoffs or workforce reduction as a result of either efficiency or productivity. Because what's always happens, at least in my organizations, is we reallocate the resources to the backlog of that's been building up that we've never gotten to, that is also important, but been deprioritized because we just don't have enough manpower. And or a company's growing in a particular vertical, product line, category, or market, and headcount is frozen. So we need to reallocate existing headcount to the growing vertical so that we can give it the attention it deserves and it can continue to grow in the double digits. And so I think it's also important that this fear-based aspect around AI taking over my job, guess what? If it does take over a job, it's on you. It's not on AI. It's because you haven't evolved. My role has changed every 2 to 3 years, and it is my job to keep the finger on the pulse and evolve with it. The role of a data engineer, the role of a data scientist, the role of a data architect, the role of a BPO in ERP migrations, our jobs change, and you need to change with it. So there's an evolution, and I think AI can complement and supplement, but it doesn't need to replace as long as you're continually learning and evolving. But scenarios where there's fear in terms of I'm going to get laid off because of it, more than likely you're going to get reassigned because of it and into something cool, potentially, or new, potentially. And if that doesn't excite you, I just don't know what would.
Large language models are revolutionizing how we interact with technology. With companies rapidly adopting models like the GPT and Llama series architectures, the demand for skilled LLM engineers is soaring. That's why Kirill and Atlan, who have taught machine learning to millions of professionals, have created the Large Language Models A to Z course. Packed with deep insights on tokenization, input embedding, transformers, self-attention, and LLM tuning, this course will help you gain hands-on experience with LLMs and stay competitive in today's job market. Enroll at superdatascience.com/LLM course for your free 14-day trial. This course is exclusively available in the Super Data Science community. You won't find it anywhere else. Once again, the link is superdatascience.com/LLM course.
Yeah, especially if AI is taking away, typically AI is taking away something relatively repetitive. And so it's getting you into, you know, being reallocated to more creative, more impactful work, which, you know, you think most people would be happy about. This reminds me, talking about resources reminds me of something that you were about to start telling me before we started recording. And so I just had you put a pin in that as well, which is that you, when you are building out teams, you keep funding for data science and data engineering separate. Do you want to tell us about that?
I think the field of data engineering is probably one of the most underappreciated spaces and probably the one that I adore, revere, and protect the most. And I wrote a post about this in LinkedIn once. I'm like, nothing functions. Nothing happens without a data engineer. I don't care if it's a digital campaign. I don't care if it's a new product launch. I don't care if you're standing up a system so that you could sell in a new market. It could be anything. It does not happen without a data engineer because no business process can be enabled and no growth can be achieved without information. And information is derived from data. And it's all about making sure that data is in the right place at the right time for the right people. And who makes that happen? It's the community of data engineers. I only have that appreciation because long time ago, I was a data engineer. I accidentally fell into it. I think you and I were chatting about me going into professional sports and saying, okay, I need to grow up and take on a real job. I found my tribe and my community, but apparently I was a horrible commute, like coder. They were like, you're not allowed to touch a lick of code ever again. I was like, okay, so what do you want me to do? They're like, we don't know, but how about you communicate what we're doing? Because we want to do the work. We don't want to talk about the work. And I was like, oh, okay. So that's how I migrated from being a data engineer to being translating to what the data engineering team was doing. And that's where I gained an appreciation from it. Moving the data, protecting the data, making sure it's of the right hygiene, the orchestration of it, the availability of it, like everything is because of a data engineer. I don't need a big team of data engineers. I need a lean and mean team of really great data engineers. And I protect them very, very much so. Because then when I hire data scientists, I don't want them doing data engineering work. Their job is mostly focused on the modeling, the algorithms, the predictions, next best actions, recommendations. It's what they can do with the information once it's in the state it needs to be in. But I don't want them playing with the mining, the cleaning, the curating, all that other stuff. So I'm very respectful of crafts. So as a data engineer, you're a master of your craft. As a data scientist, you're a master of your craft. Now, of course, like with the world of full stack developers, we have back-end developers and front-end developers. Now we have full stack and the two have blend, and you can be a good full stack developer. But how can you really be a master of both sides of the fence unless all you're doing is learning 24/7? So I think it's very difficult. So I respect the division of labor and I let people do what they love to do without having to do the grunt work of things that they chose not to do. So I always try to keep the two separate.
Well, it sounds brilliant to me. That sounds like the way to go for sure. So yeah, keeping your data engineering, your data science headcounts separate, having that lean, mean team of data engineers, ensuring that the data are of great quality for the data scientists downstream to be training and deploying machine learning and AI models with. That sounds like the way to go to me for sure. Something else that, we didn't say that we were going to talk about on air, but it's something that is very interesting to me, is some organizations think that patenting isn't a great idea because you're just putting onto paper and in the public instructions for your intellectual property. And it's often difficult to be able to ensure that a competitor isn't using, say, some AI methodology of yours under the hood. How are you going to tell? But you have eight patents granted, and then many more that have been applied for that are pending. So Sol, what's the value in patents? When would you do that?
Like as a side hobby. I mean, the process of coming up with a novel idea, let's say you have a novel idea. It's not that someone else may not have come up with the idea before, or components of your novel idea don't already exist. It's really how you put that together that creates that novel idea. Now, you can file a patent within an enterprise and an organization, and they'll cover all your legal fees for you, but they technically own the patent. Or you can do it on your own. But the process of distinguishing whether or not it's novel, paying the legal fees to file it, and then by the time my patents have been filed and granted, anywhere from 2 to 5 years, because the Patent and Trademark Office is so behind. Do it because it makes you feel good, but not because there's this higher altruistic intent behind it. Making money off of patents is unlikely because the fact that you discovering someone's using your patent, it's a different story. And it's money out of your pocket. So I think it's more for bragging rights, kind of like writing a book. It's amazing, good experience. You could say you did it. You're not going to make money off of it unless you are literally a full-time writer and it's not going to be your first book. There's a second and a third and a fourth and a fifth. And that is your vocation. That is your career. So I would say patents is more for bragging rights than anything else at this point in time. The one exception I would say is if you're in industrial or telco or manufacturing and pharmaceuticals, that's where it absolutely makes the most sense because things are a bit more finite. Because a novel idea isn't in stitching together components that already exist that makes it novel. It's a molecule, a very specific molecular structure that leads to an output. You have a patent on that. Guess what? You own treatment for pancreas cancer, which is a very, very specific type of cancer because you found the right molecular structure that has the highest probability of decreasing that tumor size. You're going to do well in the oncology space or in manufacturing, figuring out that one solvent that doesn't increase the heat coefficiency level of when machine piles actually grate against each other. People are going to have an interest in that. So they're going to want to buy into that patent because they also need solvents that consistently remove the heat coefficient level when two tectonic like metal plates rub against each other. So there are certain industries where it can lead to financial gains. Otherwise, for us in the tech space, it's really, really hard to do anything financially with it. If anything, it's more out of pocket than.
Another great example there of your cross-industry experience providing a lot of value to us as listeners. You really got in the weeds there around pharmaceuticals. So yeah, another great reason to be checking out Sol's new book, just out last week, Your AI Survival Guide, Scraped Knees, Bruised Elbows, and Lessons Learned from Real World AI Deployments. I, for one, am definitely going to be checking this one out. Sol, before I let you go, I ask my guests always for a book recommendation other than their own book. Do you have anything interesting for us?
I've got a goodie and an oldie. I don't know if anyone ever read Andre Agassi's book called Open. Now, I'm an avid reader and I have 7 books going on at the same time. And like, whether it's, don't laugh at me, but it could be about the Cambodian genocide. It could be about Business Made Simple from Donald Miller. It could be about the history of sex. It could be about feminine and masculine archetypes. It could be turning data into profit from Vin. It could be about, there's just a ton that I read, like massive. I can't even count how many leadership books. But it was probably the first book I read cover to cover that I did not want to put down. And it's called Open, O-P-E-N. And it was about Andre Agassi's life. And it was interesting because
that's the one where he like admits to smoking crack, something like that,
and wearing a wig. Andre, and most people probably won't know who he is anymore, but he was a really famous tennis player. But for those old as I am,
that's crazy. If people don't know who he is. He's incredible. Yeah,
he's amazing. But you saw him from the outside, and when he was dating Brooke Shields, and he was a phenomenal tennis player. And he does a phenomenal job of telling the story of how every day he was insecure when he went on the court and how his relationship with Brooke Shields was the most horrible relationship he'd ever have because he really was in love with someone else. But because of reasons that he wasn't aware of, he stuck with it. But then also going bald at such an early age and then having to wear a wig because he created this persona of himself and then having to keep up with the image. It was probably one of the first books that was really open, hence, and vulnerable about, we all have our own insecurities. No one is perfect. What we see really isn't that person and that intent. There's a lot to unpack. And so it was just the first book that to this day, I still remember the author. I still remember the title. And I remember I was traveling in Europe on a Eurorail and I finished that book just on the train. So it's an oldie, but it's phenomenal.
Nice. And so when you said you have an oldie and a goodie, book that's both an oldie and a goodie. Okay, I won't wait for a second one. I guess it wouldn't make sense to have an old recommendation that wasn't good. You're going to have an old bad book and a new good book. It doesn't make sense. Nice. Open by Andre Agassi. Very cool. I think that also probably plays on, it's a double entendre with him being open, but also think like, performing in the US Open.
Oh, 100%. 100%. And just the amount of discipline and rigor that went into him being a master of his own craft. I just had a ton of respect. But like the insecurities that followed with it. And I know we all have it. So it was just, I don't know, you would never have expected it from someone like that. So it was refreshing.
Yeah, it is. It is great to be reminded that for all the amazing things that you see leaders do out there behind the hood, most of us are shaking in our boots, feeling like we have no idea what we're doing.
Totally. And even if we do, we're always surprised with how much we don't know.
Mm-hmm. And actually, I would venture to say that the few people I have met in my career who don't have that kind of fear, they're most likely to be the kind of person that you described right at the outset of this episode, to bring things back, that are climbing their way up the corporate ladder with more with skill sets other than IQ.
With color. Yes. There's some overinflation and exaggeration and posturing that goes on. But you can spot those out. If you pay attention to your intuition, you can tell like at a heartbeat.
It's easy, Sol. You just slap AI on it.
Yeah. Powered by AI.
AI can do anything.
So easy. Just powered by AI.
Yes. All right. So glad to be able to get back to that point. Sol, this has been an amazing episode. I wish I had more time with you.
Another summit sees.
Well, yeah, but I mean also on air, hopefully we can get another slot booked with you in the near future, because I feel like we really just scratched the surface.
Yeah. Of the insights. I think you have an opening for podcast number 918 or 923.
I'll mark it down.
Yeah. Thanks. I love being numbers.
Oh, well, really appreciate it, Sol. But before I let you go, I do have to ask you how our audience should be following you to get insights between now and episode number 918.
I do have a newsletter, solrashidi.substack.com. I will post like some real nitty gritty stuff. It's very transparent. It's very direct. I just got into the space, by the way, so I'm trying the content stuff out, but I've gotten some really good traction, which is great. LinkedIn is my primary post. I'm so sorry. I'm not an IG-er or TikToker, but LinkedIn and the newsletter are the two primary forms.
With our audience, we're used to hearing LinkedIn as the most common social media platform today. So
yeah,
you have nothing to apologize for.
Well, thank you. I so appreciate being on this. And congratulations to your success, John. Like, you've been a phenomenal entrepreneur. And I mean, just to have the tenacity of doing, I know you've got over 700 podcasts and you've done over half of them. Like, kudos to you. You've been at this game a long time and you're still showing up and you're still showing up engaged and committed. And that makes me happy because the fatigue hasn't set in because you obviously do what you love. And that matters a lot.
Well, thank you, Sol. Yeah, it is easy with all the other things going on in my life outside of the podcast. It is always easy to stay motivated about the podcast because I get to have time with someone like you and get to interview you and get these amazing insights. So it's invaluable to me. And it's awesome that people enjoy tuning in and listening in. That's like it's like an added benefit on the side almost. All right, Sol. Catch you again in episode 918. We'll see you then.
You got it. Take care. Bye.
Well, I really do hope we can get Sol back on the show again soon. In today's episode, Sol filled us in on how CDOs and related roles have such high turnover because there's no clear division of labor relative to CIO and CTO. They're brought in to fix data governance and quality issues that the enterprise doesn't have the right culture to fit. And back office high IQ people get outflanked by other smooth C-suite execs. She also talked about how high criticality, low complexity AI projects are the ones with the highest probability of success, how enterprises with greater than $100 million in revenue tend to have what-ifs around data security and privacy that could be overcome today with straightforward technological solutions like Protopia's stained glass data masking solution. And she talked about how having a lean, mean team of data engineers ensures that data scientists downstream get high-quality training data for their models and they don't get bogged down by data engineering work. As always, you can get all the show notes, including the transcript for this episode, the video recording, any materials mentioned on the show, the URLs for Sol's social media profiles, as well as my own, at superdatascience.com/781. If you'd like to engage with me in person, as opposed to just online, on May 17th, I'll be hosting a panel live at the New York R Conference. The panel will feature iconic open source community members, Drew Conway, JD Long, Sumia Kalra, and Jared Lander. There's always pizza and beers afterwards, so we can catch up over a cold one then. Huge names like Hadley Wickham, Andrew Gelman, Hillary Mason, Wes McKinney, and Sean Taylor will all be there at such a crazy lineup. The New York R Conference is one not to miss regardless of what programming language you do data science in. All right, thanks to my colleagues at Nebula for supporting me while I create content like this Super Data Science episode for you. And thanks, of course, to Ivana, Mario, Natalie, Serge, Sylvia, Zar, and Kirill on the Super Data Science team for producing another jaw-droppingly awesome episode for us today. For enabling that super team to create this free podcast for you, we are ever so deeply grateful to our sponsors. You can support the show by checking out our sponsors' links, which are in the show notes. And if you yourself are interested in sponsoring an episode yourself, you can get the details on how you can do that by making your way to johncrone.com/podcast. Otherwise, share this episode with someone who would love it, review it, subscribe if you're not a subscriber, and all those kinds of good things. But most of all, just keep on tuning in. I'm so grateful to have you listening, and I hope I can continue to make episodes you love for years and years to come. Until next time, keep on rocking it out there, and I'm looking forward to enjoying another round of the Super Data Science Podcast with you very soon.